Welcome to the podcast series from the 9th EMN Educational Seminar on Migration 2023, entitled Protection of Migrants in Vulnerable Situations, organized by the European Migration Network in Slovakia. You're listening to the lecture presenting investigative case study that tackled the question of how to best cover and communicate human trafficking stories. Tips for Policymakers and Journalists by Marta Mendoza, investigative journalist and Pulitzer Prize winner at the Associated Press in USA. Marta's reporting has prompted White House responses and the introduction of new legislation, ultimately resulting in overturned conviction. Collaborating closely within a team, she initiated investigations into slavery in the Thai seafood business, which led to the freedom of more than 2,000 men. Earlier reporting uncovered a U.S. Army massacre of hundreds of civilians during the early stages of the Korean War. Enjoy the lecture.
I'm going to talk about the people who Heather works with, those very specifically, the people she was talking about, the fishermen and others who they arrive and they are, desperate and stuck. And one thing that needs to happen from our perspective as journalists is accountability. And that means figure out who imprisoned them, who enslaved them, and hold them accountable for their actions. And also look at these systems of business that allow them to be put in such vulnerable positions. So I'm going to share a PowerPoint. It's important to note that the work I'm talking about today is not just my work, but the work of my colleagues, Margie Mason, Robin McDowell, and Esther Toussaint as well. So for many years, we would hear about people in Southeast Asia, in this area, who had jumped off a boat, jumped off a fishing boat, run to shore, and landed to their great fortune with an NGO where they were going to try to help them get their life back together. We talked to these NGOs for 2 years and asked them, where are these men coming from? Because our stories of an individual's situation didn't resonate, nor did stories from the Washington Post or Bloomberg or others. We would meet with the NGO. They would, if the survivor was willing to talk, have them speak with us and tell us their story. But one person's story wasn't doing it. We would tell the story, and we realized what we needed to do was tell a number of people's stories and also track the seafood back to the consumers so that the governments and buyers would be held accountable as well. So as we asked, more and more people talked about a small island here in Indonesia. And as you know, Indonesia is a island-based country with 18,000 islands. And people said that they had been enslaved on one of these islands. They described it. And so we used Google Earth, as we do, to look at Pusaka Benjina. And what we saw were, if you can see on the slide, these fishing boats, hundreds of them. And we also saw what would likely be a processing facility. And so we asked to go there. And getting to Pusaka Benjina in the archipelago of Indonesia is no small task. It was an airplane to a boat, to a second boat and a third boat to get out there. But when we reached the people on this Indonesian island, communication stopped because they didn't speak Bahasa, the language of Indonesia. They were definitely on fishing boats, but we couldn't understand what was happening. And, Heather noted that she's did things early in her career and that she would reconsider. And this was certainly, we misunderstood the situation, but they were speaking Burmese. And so we did, there's no like phone service or cell service or landing strip or anything else on this island, but we could climb to the top of a hill, use a satellite phone, and we could ask our colleague in Myanmar, Esther Toussaint, to come help. And over the course of 4 days and her boyfriend's credit card, she did. In the meantime, over those 4 days, we worked to document the seafood because, as you recall, we wanted to track the seafood to wherever it was going. So we were looking at them working with it, frozen seafood coming off of boats, moving onto other boats, going to be processed. What type of fish were they? What labels were they putting on these bags of fish? what boats were they moving it onto that would then leave the island? And then when Esther arrived, this broke open. The men told her that they had been taken from villages in Myanmar and brought to Thailand, where they were given Thai passports. The reason for this is because this was a Thai seafood company in Indonesia. So it had Thai and Indonesian ownership. You were not allowed to be fishing in Indonesia's waters if you were not Thai or Indonesian. And so they were given fake IDs and fake passports, which you can see he didn't even have, but he had a copy of it, which is always a red flag to not have your own passport on your own hand. We asked to see more, meet more of the men, and they took us to a graveyard. The reason they would bring them back from sea when they were fishing and bury them was because these were property. The human beings had become property, and they needed to document what had become of them for the owners. But even here, they were buried under a fake name, under their Thai invented name, and they had lost who they were as well as their lives. Inside of those processing facilities, we found that men were being put in cages. The reason they would do that is when their boats came in to offload their seafood, if there was considered a risk that they would run into the forest, they would cage them. And my colleague Esther was soon told she needed to leave. And so she found somebody working on the docks, taught them how to use a GoPro, and had them go back in and film these men who were locked in these cages until their boats were going to leave. And they said that they had been there for 2, 5, 8 years, not just in the cages, but also on the fishing boats without being paid. And some of them gave her their parents' names or cell numbers and begged her to get in touch with their families and let them know that they were still alive. At that point, we were being, let's just say, strictly ordered off the island. And so the last piece was getting this boat here, the Silver Sea Line, and its IMO number so that we could track it. These large, large boats worth millions and millions of dollars will ping a satellite signal as they travel, and those satellite signals are mapped. And so we were planning to track this boat, not by following it on in real time, but by following it on satellite. And that's exactly what we did. We tracked this boat, and we also looked at its prior tracks to see where it had gone before. Always into Thailand, some would say just south of Bangkok, the large port. And as the boat approached, we could even see the name of the boat going on in. So when it was there, our team was there too. And this time we were physically in person there in trucks, undercover, in cabs on the back of pickup trucks without having thought through what the next plan was. We just wanted to follow the trucks. But we were very relieved to see this was the exact same Silver Sea Line boat. And it was offloading seafood into these trucks. So as we tracked these, as the trucks pulled out, we would follow them through Samutsukhan into facilities where they would either be freezing or processing or shipping the seafood. And from there, as they shipped it, we would look at what are called bills of lading. So we could see where the seafood was going from Thailand to the United States. Unfortunately, often in the United States or the EU, it was to a distributor, not to a store per se. But even then, it was the next step on the journey of that seafood. If you've ever mailed anything overseas, you have to fill out a form, a piece of paper, and that is the bill of lading. It says I'm shipping a book to somebody in another country or whatever it is. And so these are digitized in real time. Once it came to the United States distributors, we found ourselves at what's called Seafood Expo in Boston, where all of the companies that distribute seafood in the United States have their annual conference. And I put together dossiers with a picture of that island, a picture of the men in cages, and then the boats moving, and then the bill of lading that showed that their company had moved this seafood from that place. At least it was in the supply chain network. And that these this language is very important when we're talking about communicating about human trafficking. So we can't tell where one exact fish came from, although I will say that some European reporters are doing some amazing tracking, but we needed to articulate that we don't know which exact fish was caught by a slave. We can just say it reached into its network. It went into that warehouse, it went into this company, and therefore all of their seafood is tainted. I made a mistake at this conference by telling the organizers before day one what I was doing and why I was doing it. And they put out a notice with my photo on it to everybody at the conference that they had already spoken with me and they didn't have to talk to me. Nonetheless, I, you know, went to booth to booth. I had about 15 that I attract seafood to. And one company was willing to speak with me, and others, at least at their booth, I could see from their setup where their seafood went next. Also, the Thai government was already there promoting their good labor practices program for shrimp and seafood processing, which to me was yet another red flag that we would follow up on. And when I told him that we had found a Thai company was doing this, he said, no, we've already stopped labor abuse. And I said, you haven't. Let me show you on this iPad some video. And he said, well, we're going to stop that. Here are some of the brands that we tracked that seafood from Pusaka Benjina to. Fancy Feast Cat Food is just an incredibly popular brand of cat food. It's in pharmacies. It's in supermarkets. It's all over Walmart, I think you recognize. But companies like Cisco and Santa Monica Seafood are the distributors who then send food to restaurants all around the United States, as well as Stava Seafood. And these are companies that have generations of fishermen in them. And they were very upset that we had tracked this in their supply chains. We made a sticker chart to explain this to our lawyers that we had tracked slave caught seafood to Walmart in particular. So you can see here's the jail where they were locked up, and here's the Silver Sea boat. And we were very high tech about it. Here's the port in Bangkok with the trucks. And here's how we tried to write it. And it took a long time. This is not our final version. But again, talking about communication, we said slavery taints the global supply of seafood. When we saw the word taint, some people thought that meant it poisoned it. And so we needed to change that. Also here, we say the Benjina Indonesia, the Burmese slaves. Unfortunately, most people in the United States don't understand that Indonesia and Burmese are not the same thing at all. So sat on the floor and stared through the rusty bars of their locked cage. Every word was a wrestling match. Do we say rusty metal bars, or can you assume if it's rusty, then it's a metal bar? Locked cage. Why would they be staying there if it was unlocked? So do we need to say that? Hidden. Are they hidden? We found them on a tiny tropical island, thousands of miles from home. Thousands of miles is to try to flag the reader that Burmese men are not from Indonesia. Just a few yards away, other workers, and this is important when we're using the language of slavery, that if they're getting paid, then they're not enslaved potentially. Loaded cargo ships with slave-caught seafood that crowds or clouds or taints or somehow, that was a very tricky word there, the supply networks of major supermarkets, restaurants, and even pet stores in the United States. We wrestled over how to begin this and how to write this, but we finally got it down in a way that our lawyers and our editors and our readers understood. And when that story broke, it was very big news. And within a week, the Indonesian government sent the Navy and police to the island and began interviewing the men on the boats. And of course, we were there as well. And my colleague Robin said, you know, what are you going to do with these guys after you interview them? They can't just go back on their boat. Their captain will abuse them at the very least, or kill them for telling you their stories. And they said, we're going to take them with us. And then they went out with megaphones and in Laotian, Cambodian, Thai, Indonesian, and Vietnamese. They said, if you are stuck here, if you have been abused here and are stuck here, come out, come down to the port, and we are going to take you home. And it was beginning to pour rain, as you might have ever experienced in Indonesia or that region, just dumping rain, and people began coming out from everywhere. And they were telling them they're going to take them and get them home. And the mood was palpable. People understood. And there was dozens of men, young men, who were all of a sudden realizing that this hell might be over. Although I will say that they kept very close track of how much money they were owed and hadn't been paid. They gathered at the dock, and we kept rewriting the story and rewriting the story, because it was, you know, dozens of men. Okay, hundreds of men. And they asked them, who wants to get on a boat and come with us? And soon it was 200 men. And within hours, 400 men and more. And they commandeered the very boats upon which they had been enslaved in order to rescue them, because they didn't have enough space for them. And they also commandeered gas and oil from those boats in order to fuel them, to rescue them. And they had very few belongings, if anything, and they came with nothing. They were brought to a different island where there was a hurricane rescue center. And by this point, we had 800 men. It would eventually rise to 2,000 and more. And this is when the NGOs really became quite overwhelmed with this level of rescue. But they first thing they had to do was give them identification, because that had been taken away. And so the IOM began documenting the men in this way. And we asked IOM for the images, and they shared them with us. And in this way, we were able to try to tell individual stories, because these are our sons. These are our brothers. These are our family people. Like, we wanted readers and viewers to understand, this is not some person who you would never relate to. These people are people who you could be people who you love in your life. So we were really working to humanize the story of these survivors. And so we set up a website where you could click on various names and hear their story interpreted into English and other languages. And over the course of weeks and months, the IOM equipped them with clothing, suitcases, phones, and they would leave this island to go home, which is a very, very sensitive moment, as Heather was explaining. In the villages where they were heading back, word would get out that some of their boys who had disappeared so many years ago were coming back on this day. This man, Mint Nang, had been gone 22 years. This is his sister as he arrived. But other people in this village on this day were not having their loved ones come back. But his mother had never given up that he was coming back, even though she hadn't heard from him in 22 years. And his story on our website is a living hell. And she rinsed him with a tamarind water to get rid of the evilness that had occurred to him. And he swore he would never leave this village again. But in doing so, we were hearing from men who were getting returned that in that brief period between when we published and when the military and the law enforcement came, many captains had fled with their boats. And so a number of these boats actually were no longer at the island. And we used their records to figure out, kind of, they have changed their boat names, they have changed their captain names, but we could see the changes. We could see the flag changes even in documentation. And we figured out where they likely were fishing, which was in the Dog's Leg off Australia and Papua New Guinea. And so how would we find them there and hold the company accountable for this? We decided that we couldn't go there and get on a boat. It wasn't going to be safe enough for us. And so we wanted to get a satellite image of their boats. And so I called the Pentagon. I called NASA. I called anybody who would have a satellite in space that could task a camera into this area where we thought they were fishing. And I had like an elevator pitch to them, but it didn't go well until I reached this company, which is a private company now called, it's now called Maxar, but they had launched this camera in space. And I called the CEO on his cell phone and said, you know, I know this sounds nuts, but I'm a reporter. We believe that there's people fishing in this area. and being forced to fish and being trafficked. And he said, you know, I'll do it, which is like a $50,000 favor to us. But I have to tell you, you're looking for a moving needle in a haystack. You're not going to find anything. The next morning at 10 a.m., they took the photo and they called me and they sent me this image and said, you should come to Boulder, Colorado, where our analysts are. And I looked at the image on my computer and I was so disappointed, but I flew to Boulder. And when I got there, they showed me this, which is two of those small boats from the island offloading seafood onto a boat that we would eventually understand is the Silver Sea 2, a sister boat to that other large cargo ship we had tracked. We sent this image to our colleague Esther in Myanmar, and she showed it to men who had lived on these boats. And while you and I might not be able to look at this boat and identify much of it, if you had been trapped on the boat for a very long time, you would be able to identify that, yes, indeed, this is the boat where you had been enslaved or your friends had been enslaved. And so they confirmed this. And at this point, journalistically, we had quite a challenge because are we going to report this to authorities or are we going to report the news? And so we split up as a team. And some of us went to the authorities and said, we have identified what we think is another trafficking ship in this area. And some of us wrote the story. This is the fishing minister of Indonesia, Ibu Susi. And when she heard about this and when we told her about it, she sent a lower aircraft, and when the boat entered Indonesian waters, more men were arrested. They seized it, and more men were rescued. And then the prosecutions began, and the trials began, and the company was shut down, and the owners, many were imprisoned. In Thailand now, they were saying this was an Indonesian company. It's nothing to worry about for Thailand, and we knew that wasn't true. And so we actually hired and paid some of the men who had been enslaved to go undercover. This was very much their initiative. They very much wanted to do this. And they went undercover in the shrimp shacks in Thailand and identified two different shrimp shacks where people peel shrimp. I think maybe some of you call them prawns. And they were again, off many of them from Cambodia and Myanmar, and they were again being enslaved. They were not being paid, working from dawn to dusk, and we followed their trucks. And in this case, we did our tracking much more in detail so we could show the middlemen, the banks. But there was two different peeling sheds where people were getting up at 2 a.m, even children, and being forced to peel shrimp all day long and not being paid. And we did our tracking much more meticulously to many more companies in the United States. And then we asked colleagues in all 50 states to go into supermarkets and see if the shrimp in this supply chain was in their supermarket. These are very local markets, Harris Teeter, Piggly Wiggly, Schnucks. What we wanted to do was touch every consumer in the United States in their region. HEB is a Texas chain, to have them understand that this is touching them. And it was, we asked our reporters to go into markets and say, do you see this Aquastar cocktail shrimp that they were packing in that center from Thailand? It might, again, not be the exact same shrimp. Doesn't matter. It's in that supply chain. And so we had all 50 states involved. And at that point, they raided the factory and they freed these people. Now, in this case, there was immigration there, and they wanted to deport them. And we were holding them accountable on that as well. You're going to deport these people who have just been abused without reimbursing them. And so the largest seafood company in Thailand said that they would rehire them. And we did go back a year later, and they had rehired a lot of people. I'm sure that plenty were not rehired, but they did have rehired workers. They had set up a daycare. They had set up a school. They had set up a digitized system for paying people as well as providing meals. At that point, of course, our work is not done. And of course, your work is never done. But we thought that perhaps we'd put a dent in this industry. In the United States, there was a big question of why is the U.S. continuing to import products that are clearly the product of slavery? Our import laws ban importing products that were produced by people who were enslaved. but we found that there was a loophole in the law. And the loophole said, if there is a consumptive demand, then they can bring it in. The reason for this was in the 1930s, they needed to import rubber and tin as they prepared for war. And those products in the 1930s were the products of people who were forced labor. But come on, it's the 21st century. And so Congress asked to close that loophole, and Obama on his last few days in office signed the law to close that loophole. And since then, they have banned a number of products from being imported into the United States, from Uyghur hair extensions to seafood from Thailand to gloves from Cambodia. And so that has been the U.S. enforcement mechanism, has been to halt shipments when they can prove it's a product of forced labor. Again, not done. I will say Ibu Susi, the fishing minister from Indonesia, seized that second boat, and this is her on a paddleboard, and brought it in to Indonesia, where it is being made into a museum about human trafficking and seafood from slaves in Indonesia for tourists to visit. Here's one of the men we saw locked behind bars, and here's the same man. You can see just how much more healthy and alive and vibrant these people were as they headed off to their new lives or their recovered lives. I made this presentation in San Francisco to fishermen there, and they said, this is not just happening in Asia. This happens here in the United States. Come down to Fisherman's Wharf, which is a very popular tourist area in San Francisco. And so I did. And there I found a boat that actually had just had an accident. And they were trying to figure out how damaged the boat was, but they couldn't come off their boat. These were Indonesian men. And in the United States, there's a scheme where people, as long as they stay on their boat and never come off their boat, don't have to have a visa, and their captains don't have to have a visa, and their captains hold their passports. When men run off these boats, if they can get onto public transit, if they can get to a church and get some help, they can then be considered survivors of human trafficking and get what's called a T visa, which is leads to a green card and leads to citizenship. So some Indonesian men had run away, but their captains, who are Vietnamese, hold guns and threaten them with their lives. They are paid once a year. The money goes back to Indonesia. But if you are being held and forced to work, even if there's money involved, it still is human trafficking under U.S. law. Their boat had come from Honolulu, from Hawaii, and it's part of the Hawaii tuna fleet. If any of you have ever vacationed in Hawaii, it's the poke fleet. So when we began to report that these men in Hawaii were stuck on their boats, local activists took up the cause. This is Honolulu. Paradise, right? But the fishing scene there is absolutely disgusting. Very desperate. And the captains hold their passports. This was a crew from Kiribati. And to get there, they come from sea. They don't come through land because they would need a visa. They come from Indonesia or Kiribati or other countries, Philippines. Over, they'll fly to Amsterdam, they'll fly to American Samoa, and then a boat will go fetch them. They are inspected on their boats. And when we confronted the U.S. government, they let us tag along on their inspections. But you can imagine that this crew of fishermen are probably not going to tell this crew of law enforcement that they don't have their passports and that they're under working conditions that would never, ever be allowed to continue in the United States. There was no interpreter. Like, this just was not good inspection of labor situations. The captains would take the lead. These federal agents had no sensitivity to human trafficking and what they needed to be asking about. But the fact that they could never, ever set foot off their boat when they came to shore made this a very obvious and simple to explain situation. And we hopped on the boats and handed phones to these individuals with somebody in Indonesia or Philippines or Vietnam or whatever country they were from. And they would take our phone, walk somewhere quiet on the boat and conduct an interview. And that is how we were obtaining their stories and situations. The advocacy there continues. It's gone to their state Supreme Court. At this point, the fishery is continuing these abuses. They've promised to build out dormitories, et cetera, but we haven't seen them. And that is where we stopped with this. I'm going to stop sharing. We also look at labor abuse from in every situation we can. If a denim factory burns in India, we immediately look at where did that denim go. And we're constantly trying to identify those supply chains so that the countries and the consumers can hold the people who put people in these situations accountable. And that, with that, do any of you have questions? You can ask me anything.
Thank you, Martha.
This lecture was part of the 9th EMN Educational Seminar on Migration, entitled Protection of Migrants in Vulnerable Situations. The seminar is organized by the International Organization for Migration Slovakia as the coordinator of the Slovak EMN National Contact Point. This activity is funded by the European Union and co-funded by the Ministry of Interior of the Slovak Republic. Thank you for listening. Thank you.